Today on Doomed! As the coronavirus continues to spread throughout the United States, and really the world, we're going to be taking a look today on Doomed with Matt Binder, on what white nationalists are doing right now. I mean, the whole world has turned to coronavirus, and rightfully so, but here on this show, where we cover the far right, we're going to make sure that the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, and even the militia groups aren't escaping the scrutiny that they well deserve. And we're really going to be going into what they're basically doing, because quite frankly, they're taking advantage of the coronavirus pandemic right now. We'll go through how they've changed their views, at least some of them have, and where they've decided to basically pivot to in the coronavirus, I guess, industry we have now, being that the pandemic has taken over every facet of our lives. And joining me to do that, let me bring us up here on the YouTube stream, is Devin Burghardt. He's the president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. He's been tracking the far right for a long time, which makes him quite welcome on this show. And we'll actually talk about how he got involved in all this. As I was telling him earlier when we were talking about it, his introduction to this world is basically, you know, right in my wheelhouse. Devin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks, Matt. I'm glad to be here.
Now, if you're tuning in for the first time, subscribe on youtube.com/Matt Binder. You can also find the show at patreon.com/Matt Binder, where you can support the show. If you're watching on the live stream on YouTube, you could also send the super chat during the show. If you want to send a super chat question for Devin, I will get that to him at the end of the free half of the show. It's also live on Facebook, Twitch, and on Twitter via Periscope. Devin, let's get right into it. Before we get into these two articles here, that these two new reports from your organization, I actually want to shout out one of the authors of one of those reports who, well, why don't you explain it as his coworker?
Well, yeah, I want to give a shout out to Chuck Tanner, who is one of the best people doing work on covering the far right in the country. And it was unfortunate that he was hospitalized last week with what appears to be a pneumonia, which may be related to COVID-19. We're really fortunate that he's back home now and he's recuperating. But, you know, it was touch and go there for a while. And, you know, we just want to send out the best to him and his family.
Absolutely. And interesting that they, in terms of celebrities that get these coronavirus tests to confirm they are definitely positive, surprisingly, far-right researchers aren't up there with the NBA players and the Hollywood stars and the Billboard top 40 artists, unfortunately, right? I mean,
yeah, not yet.
Not yet. We'll get there. We'll get there. There'll be people will be clamoring for more Chuck and Devin and Matt Binder one day.
Yeah.
So, Devin, before we get into these two pieces, actually, you know, I was basically making sure I introduced you right for the show and came across your bio. And there was something interesting for me, especially, as to how you got into basically tracking the far right. And it is via the punk rock scene, which, as anyone who listens to this show knows, that there are basically two things I try to tie everything I cover into, and one is pro wrestling and the other is punk rock. No matter what it is politics wise, I'll always find a way to somehow make an analogy to punk rock or pro wrestling. But when we talk about white supremacy and neo-Nazis, the punk rock scene is actually not just analogous. It is very much part of that world. And I don't mean, like, you know, that there's a whole big, you know, punk rock equals neo-Nazis, but the punk rock scene has been battling with neo-Nazis, at least the modern-day neo-Nazi movement, I mean, more than anyone. And I stress modern-day because obviously people fighting Hitler literally were a little bit more involved. But the modern-day white supremacist movement the punk rock scene has been on the front lines.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in Spokane, Washington, which, you know, for your listeners will know, is pretty much a stone's throw away from the Aryan Nations compound at Hayden Lake, Idaho. So when I was coming up in the early 1980s, you know, going to local punk shows, you know, attending, you know, house parties and all that kind of stuff, almost every weekend at different times, we would have white power skinheads come over from the Aryan Nations compound to either recruit or beat up my friends. So, you know, I had a really visceral, you know, firsthand experience with this stuff growing up. I think one of my first real big political actions was to take part in a small demonstration in downtown Spokane against Robert Matthews, who would later go on to form the Order, you know, the violent white supremacist terrorist organization, which robbed an armored car for over $3 million, killed a Jewish talk show host and a Missouri state trooper. So, you know, I was very much in tune to the kind of stuff going on around me. You know, it was while I was still in high school that, you know, a Catholic priest in Hayden Lake was bombed by an Aryan Nation splinter. There were assassination attempts. There were car bombings. There was all of this stuff going on around me, while at the same time I was becoming politicized by music and getting involved in the punk scene. So that really formed, you know, kind of a core of my thinking about this stuff for a long time. And I stayed active on it and, you know, really stayed engaged. You know, as I went off to school, I was coming up at a time when there was kind of a decline in the big social movements, right? It was at the end of the Central American solidarity and anti-apartheid stuff. You know, I went through the anti-war movement, obviously, with the first Gulf War. We were not successful at stopping it. You know, I, for a while, tried looking at the, you know, the environmental movement, but the idea of, you know, basically at that time, helping protect the environment for wealthy white people to recreate wasn't really my thing. So, you know, I was really looking for a place to plug in and do racial and social justice work when some folks with an organization based out of Portland called the Coalition for Human Dignity, a group which was formed in the wake of the Mulugeta Sarah murder by a group of white power skinheads, came and gave a talk at my university. And from that moment on, I was hooked. I was like, how do I get involved? What do I do? You know, so I started interning with that organization. They immediately started sending me to Klan rallies and militia meetings to gather up intelligence and figure out what's going on. You know, and that's been over 25 years now. So I guess that's a long answer to your question.
No, that's really fascinating. And, you know, we're from slightly different generations, but when I remember, you know, when I turned 16 in the early 2000s, the first thing I did was I went to CBGB's, and I specifically remember my first show at CB's was Oxymoron, and you know I remember specifically at that show and specifically at a hardcore fest at CB's a few months after. Really understanding from seeing some of the people there. Now, remember, this is in New York City. So, I mean, people like to think, oh, you know, it's diverse. That's not happening there. But I specifically remember seeing, you know, Nazis, neo-Nazis, and, you know, skinhead neo-Nazis. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, damn, like, you know, this isn't like, you know, people, I don't think people realize this is still a thing at this point. You know, this is, you know, during the Bush administration. This is before, you know, white supremacists came back from underground, I guess you can say, and decided it was their moment in the sun once again. And, you know, the punk rock scene has been talking about this forever. And I, you know, as a teen, until I hit this moment, I remember thinking, like, you know, why are all these punk bands still singing about this stuff? I don't see these Nazis around, you know, but this is when I'm like, you know, 11, 12, first getting into, you know, skate punk and stuff. So, like, people who I think got involved in punk rock, regardless of what generation you were in, I mean, none of this we're seeing now is so surprising to us. Like, I think that's what a lot of people don't, like, obviously, you know, we could have, you know, maybe guessed if this would have ever happened in terms of their revival in the mainstream or whatever. But I mean, we always knew they were there when I think a lot of people, 2016 hits and everyone's all of a sudden like, oh, I never even knew this was still a thing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I know that you know, over the years, we've run into trouble helping people understand that not only is it there, but it's ever mutating. So far often, more often than not, I think what we find for folks who aren't really paying close attention to this is they're fighting the last battles. You know, they're looking for what white supremacy used to look like rather than what it looks like actually today. You know, and that's another one of the big reasons why I was really excited to be on your show is because, you know, even when you were at MR, one of the things you were really good at was pointing to those new trends, right? In fact, you know, even someone like myself who's been looking at this stuff for 25 years wasn't paying as close of attention to, you know, the men's rights stuff and to the, you know, some of the other extremely online activities. So, you know, I got to give you a big shout out for doing some of that work.
Why, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no.
But, you know, let's actually talk about that for a minute, because I think we will possibly see something like that happen again. And what I mean by that, I mean there's a specific time period from about 2012 to early 2015 where there was this new white supremacist, neo-Nazi, and saying movement actually isn't correct, because these were multiple different scattered movements. I mean, you got men's rights, like you mentioned. On top of that, you have some people within the PUA world, and then even on top of that, you have men going their own way. And now, you know, these things all overlap in a Venn diagram, but they're actually very distinct movements. And then aside from that, you then have what comes out in, what was it, 2014, Gamergate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even the Gamergate movement came from different sub-movements. You know, you had 4chan, and then, you know, 8chan came out of that whole thing to begin with Gamergate. And you had these scattered different, you know, basically what people online would just basically know is like, oh, these are, you know, crappy, you know, troll areas of the internet that we shouldn't pay attention to if you want to have a serious discussion, you know, just for people messing around and being assholes and being generally shitty. But what we saw was, while there was that, you know, there were certainly people who were just doing that and didn't have any political ideology, there was also a huge amount, you know, a huge portion of those people who did have an ideology and was using that movement, those different sites, to create this movement, I should say. And you're right when you say that, you know, these all became the current, all moved up into the current white supremacist movement. And the interesting thing there is, you know, when we talk about, you know, coming up in the punk scene, you know, those skinheads, they had, you know, those racist skinheads, they had, you know, Nazi swastika tattoos. They were, you know, openly basically putting out their traditional white supremacist sort of, you know, icons or signage. But these guys aren't doing that. You know, they're sharing the ideology, they're spreading that, and, you know, of course there's the 4chan trolls using the swastika and being generally assholes, but, you know, the men's rights guys weren't throwing up the swastika or going Sig Hail or even necessarily being overt about their white supremacism anyway. You know, they were generally able to move into and you don't even really hear about the men's rights guys as men's rights guys so much anymore, because the men's rights movement has basically become this far-right movement we see now. That's basically a complete overlap in a Venn diagram with white supremacists.
Yeah, and I think what they did, and it's really an important point to stress, is what they did is they really helped supercharge misogyny inside of the white supremacist movement. Right? Beforehand, you know, there were even attempts, you know, to try to break the white supremacist glass ceiling for women in the movement. But with the rise of, you know, the men's rights stuff and the go your own way stuff and, you know, now the black pill stuff and whatnot, it has created that kind of supercharging of anti-feminism, misogyny, and sexism inside that movement, which has helped to gain a lot of new hyper-alienated young white men into the movement and changed the dynamic once again.
Right. I think what you're going to see, actually, and it's already happening, but I think it's going to grow even more so now that basically overt white supremacism, once it got into the forefront here with Trump ascending to the presidency and then basically losing that sort of, you know, street cred, I guess, that comes with, not having, you know, not being in power. You know, once they get their guy in power and he's a big disappointment to them, which he actually is a big disappointment to a large portion of the white supremacists, which might surprise some people, you know, they sort of fall back a little bit. But what you will see, actually, is the ascension of more people who are, let's call it Tim Pool brain. People who are, you know, just coming across as regular schlubs, you know, just regular, you know, I'm just a white guy who's got opinions. And what they're really doing is pushing this sort of anti-diversity message, really. When Tim Pool goes out there shitting on social justice warriors all the time, what he's really saying is he's basically putting out, you know, far-right rhetoric.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a, you know, there has been a space created for those folks to try and whitewash the kind of white nationalism that they're being promoted. You know, that's what we see with, you know, groups like the American Identity Movement and all the Graper stuff. They're really at the forefront of trying to push hardcore white nationalist ideas into the mainstream by stripping off, you know, the Klan robes or the swastika tattoos and trying to make it look respectable. You know, it's a strategy that first kind of piloted by David Duke back in the 70s and 80s when he ran for the legislature, you know, and won a seat in the Louisiana House of Representatives. And it is something now that is again returned to fashion as they see it an opportunity, that they see a shot for themselves inside the mainstream to at least peel off new folks and to grow their ranks by looking more respectable and playing to the camera.
Right. They traded in the hood for a beanie.
Yeah.
So let's get into this. Now, obviously, the coronavirus is basically taking over, I would say, American life, but it's really taking over life worldwide. I mean, people are basically all around the world being affected by this. And
I have a friend in Paris who's currently in the hospital.
Right.
Suffering from. Yeah. Right. So, and yeah, it's.
Although I have seen that schools in South Korea are set to open up next week. I don't know if that's good. I mean, they really, you know, South Korea and, you know, and Hong Kong and Taiwan have done an incredible job with this. I mean, it's just, you know, I guess the cultures are just different. They're much more. They care much more about the society as a whole there than, I guess, us Americans with our freedom and our individualism and our. But that's...
Yeah, you don't have Ammon Bundy's running around over there telling them it's a government plot and that you should be out on the streets rather than, you know, social distancing and staying at home.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a big difference.
Right. So most of the world is dealing with this right now in a way that's keeping them at home. And if not at home, either on the front lines of a service job or on the front lines in the medical field. So, I mean, or if you're lucky, maybe you're on a yacht like David Geffen, or you're in a nice jacuzzi like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I still can't get over that. I don't know if you saw that video he put out. I still can't get over it.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Nothing will reach the youth of America to tell them to stay home in their studio apartments, if they even have that. Maybe a basement with parents, if they're even lucky enough to have a basement. You know, really stuck in small quarters than a Hollywood celebrity in his jacuzzi smoking a cigar saying, "Look how easy staying at home is." Give me a break.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of tangents I'm going on here because of this coronavirus. You can tell I've been indoors for way too long.
Yeah, I hear you. Trust me.
But we're all dealing with this. And I think because everyone's been, you know, everything I've seen is coronavirus, and rightfully so. But you put out, your organization put out two great reports that are basically looking at how A, militia groups, and B, white nationalists, which, again, want to bring up a Venn diagram, I would say it's almost completely overlapped. Maybe not quite. Let's give it to a few militia members who might not be fully on board with white supremacy yet, but it's close enough. these groups are leveraging the coronavirus to spread their ideology. And I think it would be dangerous to not take the time to cover this, which is why I'm having you on, because when the coronavirus is hopefully comes to an end, this pandemic comes to an end in the next few months, fingers crossed, even if it takes what experts are saying could be a year to a year and a half, but even if that's the case, these people and these groups will still be here, and who knows how many people they will have won over while basically people are sitting home with nothing to do and will possibly come across this stuff, this messaging, this material, this content, and maybe they'll get on board. I mean, I've been covering on this show so much how, you know, the rise among young Generation Z and millennials in getting involved in white supremacy via YouTube, falling down the rabbit hole by, you know, one day they're just falling on a Dennis Prager, a PragerU video, or a Ben Shapiro video, and the next thing they know, they're looking at whatever literally overt white supremacist channel that no longer is on YouTube because most of them seem to have been banned at the, for the most part, the big ones have, it seems like. But, you know, there's a whole generation of people who are now on board white supremacy because of that, and I fear that, you know, you might have another boom in that world because of the coronavirus.
Well, you know, just before we came on, I saw a new Pew study that showed that I think it was 22 or 23% of the American public thinks that the coronavirus is a government conspiracy. So, you know, these ideas have already moved pretty rapidly from the margins to the mainstream, right? So they're already infecting the way people are thinking about the virus. And that has real implications for not only how we think about it, but also how we respond to it, you know, and whether or not we're able to, you know, think about this collectively with, you know, mutual aid and other kinds of, you know, approaches to it, or we head down that rabbit hole where we become hyper individualist, where we start pulling out our guns and worried that everyone's coming to take our toilet paper.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the guns because let's segue into the militia groups first. And the interesting thing about you bringing up the guns is I have seen I came across a chart with very interesting data. I wish I had it pulled up, but I wasn't planning on bringing it up, but you gave me a perfect opening for it. I saw a chart that basically said that Americans are now buying more guns because of the coronavirus than any other event that happened that spurred a boom in people buying firearms. And previously, the biggest boom for gun shops was right after Sandy Hook, when everyone thought that, wow, a bunch of kindergartners and first graders, I think it was, got murdered in this horrible school shooting. And if, you know, if anything is going to cause this country to give a second look at how we treat guns in our society and in our laws, this has got to be the one. So, of course, we found out that was not the case. This country will take children being mowed down by firearms and just go, and brush it off, sadly.
Well, and before that, you know, before that, the last big increase was after President Obama got elected. That was the last big spike in gun sales before then.
Right.
So it is, you know, it is, that kind of thing is very real, you know, and listening to a podcast of far right activists from Eastern Washington, he started talking about how many gun dealers were worried about what they called the Trump slump, right? That gun sales had declined and that they weren't able to sell the same kind of the same amount of guns that they did during the Obama era because nobody was worried about losing them, but that this has changed their fortunes quite significantly because everyone was running out to buy one because of the kind of fear and hysteria that some folks have been pushing out about coronavirus and our response to it.
Right. So you know, it's let's get into these militia groups, because I don't want to, we've been talking about it so much and it's been great, but I definitely want to cover these reports because I feel like, you know, I want to know how these guys are leveraging the coronavirus. I mean, there's some interesting stuff in terms of the pivot. And I mean, we've seen that even with the mainstream right wingers who went from this coronavirus is all a hoax to take down Trump to the coronavirus is a Chinese plot to get us to some of them are now going out to hospitals to film a 45-second video clip showing no one driving into the hospital with coronavirus as proof that the media is making up that this is something dire at our hospitals, which is, you know, I know if I had coronavirus, the first thing I would do is I would hop in my car and drive myself down to the local hospital, take the time to find some parking. I want to get a good spot now. And, you know, I get that spot and then I'd mosey on down to the front door, not the emergency room, not the emergency entrance, but you should know. Just get to that front door and go right in.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's ridiculous. You know, so for the militias, their trajectory is pretty similar, right? They've essentially adopted one of three or all of three different approaches to looking at the coronavirus. The first is to argue that it's a hoax, right? To downplay the threat and to say that there's nothing to it. You know, those are the folks who are really who drunk the Trump Kool-Aid and are still diehard supporters. So if they're committed to protecting the current regime, they're more likely to try to downplay the coronavirus and say it's a hoax and spin out all kinds of nonsense about it. Just the most insane gibberish you can possibly imagine, but it gets recirculated over and over and over again, and people start believing it. You know, the second thing that I think is the most common is the belief in conspiracy theories, right? And those take a couple different forms. You know, the first of those forms is the idea that that somehow that this is a plot by the Democrats and or the deep state to destroy President Trump. Again, those are folks who are diehard Trump supporters who are really into that. You know, they've adopted the position that because one of the folks at the CDC had a connection to one of the folks who worked on the Mueller report, that therefore it was all tied together and therefore it's all part of the entire deep state plot that overthrow Trump because they couldn't do it with impeachment. The other way that they approach the idea of it being a hoax is they argue, you know, they start, you know, using anecdotal evidence to say, I don't see anyone getting sick. Do you see anyone getting sick? I don't know anyone getting sick. Therefore, it can't be a problem, right? So they continue to downplay it, and they have for quite a while. There are still some folks doing that, but it's a little bit less. I mean, that's decreased quite a bit as the sheer overwhelming numbers have come in and because President Trump has shifted directions as well. So the idea of downplaying, I think, has decreased quite a bit. The second area where they're really big. Oh, go ahead.
No, please.
Right. You know, that second area where they're really big is the idea of promoting conspiracy theory. Right. And there are two main variants of that. You know, the first is the idea that this is, you know, it's an opportunity for them to push nativism and xenophobia, you know, claiming that this was somehow a virus that was concocted in a lab in Wuhan, China, either as a biological weapon or as, you know, that they either deliberately or unintentionally released into the wild. You know, so they will use that and talk about, you know, the Kung Flu or talk about, you know, the various different ways in which they want to, you know, go after, you know, the Chinese for doing this. And of course, that kind of conspiracy rhetoric has real implications here in the U.S., as we've seen the number of hate crimes and assaults against Asian Americans spike dramatically. So, you know, once again, conspiracies are becoming action and people are taking those words quite literally and lashing out at folks that they think are different because they think that this is somehow, you know, a plot by the Chinese. And so that's the one thing. And then, you know, the other conspiracy that has made the rounds quite a bit is the regurgitating of the old George Soros conspiracy, right? The idea that Soros, because he owns, you know, part of some company that owns some patent linked to a coronavirus, not this one, but because he has those links, therefore he is doing this to deliberately sink the economy so he can therefore take over control and or, you know, bring about his view of, you know, a liberal state, you know, and take down Trump because he said he wanted to take down Trump. So they think that somehow he was diabolical enough to come out with this kind of approach to get rid of the president rather than, you know, supporting a presidential candidate to run against him or do anything else. He, you know, somehow came up with this solution. And often embedded in that kind of stuff, obviously, is, as it has been from day one, you know, either an implicit or an explicit anti-Semitism. You know, it's a way to bring anti-Semitism back into the conversation. It happens a lot more with the white nationalist side, but it's certainly ever present even in the militia circle.
Right.
So, it's, you know, that's all there.
It's interesting that they go with the George Soros is involved with all this, because in normie conspiracy theories, because they don't have the whole anti-Semitic bent to it, they attribute this all to Bill Gates. Have you noticed that?
Well, there is that. Yeah, yeah. There is that conspiracy as well, right? There is the, you know, there is the Bill Gates and Barack Obama conspiracy theory, which circulates as well, saying that because, you know, Bill Gates and Barack Obama had something to do with a Netflix series called Pandemic, that somehow they knew it was coming and they were prepared for it. And, you know, again, you know, if you want to read the article and find out all the you know, the underlying assumptions based in these conspiracy theories, you know, it's there, but, you know, it's a bunch of garbage and it is, go ahead.
I will say definitely a bunch of garbage, but when I saw that the Pandemic show come out on Netflix, I definitely was like, man, the timing on this, it's the producers of it must be, you know, thinking, man, this went good for me.
I mean, oh, sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the conspiracies, right? There's always that grain of truth, right?
Right, it's
always,
right.
You know, it's a fortunate incident of timing.
Right.
Yeah? So, yeah.
I actually put on an episode of it, the first episode one night, and I ended up falling asleep. Not because I was just tired and I fell asleep. And I swear to God, with it playing in the background, I had the worst dreams. And I woke up and I was just like, I just woke up feeling depressed. And I was like, it was still on TV. And I was like, I got to shut this off, man. This is not good stuff to sleep to.
No, that is definitely not stuff to watch right before bed.
Yeah, right, right. Tiger King, however, definitely what you should be watching right now. Especially if you just need to just view the most insane stuff ever, yet still just get away from all the problems in the current world. It's just, have you watched?
Well, and there is a tie. Right? There is a tie, right? In that first episode of Tiger King where they're talking about, where the sheriff is talking about how he was worried about a little Waco, right?
Right.
That there is that connection, right?
Right.
Where these, you know, the third area that militia groups are really intent on, the Boogaloo.
Is Joe, right? do you have any information on this, by the way? Is Joe Exotic just a gun guy, or does he have any connection to militia groups? Do we?
He's just an Oklahoman.
Okay. Right, 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 man. I think if you ask me, I don't know how much you've seen of it. Have you watched the whole thing or
just the first episode?
Just the first episode. Okay, I don't want to ruin it for you, but there's a whole subplot in there involving someone who is not Joe Exotic that definitely needs looking into, and it's incredible. That's just an aside there. I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't. So, this is actually interesting, because would you say that, because I mentioned earlier how a lot of, you know, the hardcore white nationalists have basically found Trump to be a disappointment. Whereas it seems like the militia groups, while there is that, you know, that belief in the same sort of general ideology, it seems like a lot of them are much happier with Trump than, you know, the guys going out there who's, you know, militia groups, their number one thing is guns. The white supremacist ideology, for those who believe in it, is secondary. For the white supremacists, obviously, white supremacy is number one. It seems like the militia groups are generally happy with Trump when compared to the straight up number one priority white nationalist guys.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair to say. I think that they are.
You're breaking up a little bit.
Don't
go back and want to make sure I didn't miss anything you said.
I think that's absolutely true. About what comes next, you know, they're worried about what happens after Trump. But in general, they've been satisfied given his nativist agenda, given his pro-gun stance, given his evangelical community, which again there is a big overlap there, and overall, just looking at the kind of overall political agenda, they've been very happy. So it's been a challenge for them. Seeing some splits, right? There are some folks who are growing disenchanted.
Devin, I think our connection on Skype is going because your audio keeps breaking up. Let me call you right back just so we can get on a new connection and that should
Perfect.
Fix it.
Yeah, that was great.
All right, folks, just give me 1 second. I'm just going to call Devin right back and that should solve the issue because otherwise I'm not getting any sort of quality. Hey, Devin, what's up? I don't hear you at all now. Well, that didn't help.
Hey, can you hear me now?
There we go. Yep.
Oh, good. Okay.
There we go. Okay. Cool. So, so you were saying how there's the evangelical overlap and how they're very happy with Trump. And generally, you believe that it seems like they sort of, the gun guys aren't so worried about the future like white supremacists are when it comes to life after Trump.
Well, I think they are. I mean, I think that there's a real concern about life after Trump, right? There's already some dissatisfaction with Trump. You know, leaders like Ammon Bundy, one of the folks who led the standoff at the Malheur Refuge in Oregon a while back, you know, who was involved in the armed standoff with law enforcement at their ranch in Nevada. He not only is disenchanted with President Trump, but he's also out there now talking about the coronavirus as being nothing to worry about, and we shouldn't let the government dictate what we're doing. So he's encouraging his members, to continue to violate the stay-at-home orders in the state of Idaho, and he's encouraging others, to stand up for liberty, as they like to refer to it, and, go out and, mingle with as many people as possible, I guess. So there is that strain within them. You know, it's that kind of hyper-individualistic, often considered a kind of a Western mentality, from folks out in the West, that is, again, supercharged by folks like Ammon Bundy and others who want to, promote this stuff for a political agenda, no matter who it hurts or how many people get injured by it. That's a pretty common theme for these folks. As early back as the early 1990s, I remember going to militia meetings. I was at one, I think, in 1994 in northern Idaho, where the militia of Montana was holding a gathering. And John Trockman, the kind of bushy bearded leader of that organization, was up there flipping through all these slides on an overhead projector, talking about something called Project Jupiter 95, which was allegedly a plot by the Carter administration, of all things, to send a nuclear weapon to collide with the Levi-Shoemaker comet, to send an electromagnetic pulse back to the United States to wipe out 2/3 of the world's population. It was at this point where he told the crowd that they knew approximately when it was going to happen, but they didn't know which 2/3 of the earth it was going to take out. So you were supposed to drive around in your truck for the next 7 days, tuned to a blank spot on the AM dial. And if you heard static, you had exactly 13 minutes to get to the easternmost corner of your basement and wait there until the militia told you it was safe to come out. I don't know how many people are still waiting down there.
Wow.
But, that's the kind of stuff that you'll hear, on the militia circuit. And, that's the kind of stuff that gets promoted in what I call the prepper industrial complex. All the folks running around, selling guns or selling, all kinds of home prepper type stuff to prepare folks for the upcoming apocalypse. They're really vulnerable to these kind of conspiracies. And if someone like an Ammon Bundy picks up steam, it could make it a lot harder for both first responders dealing with these kind of pandemics, as well as folks in law enforcement who might have to deal with them if they start gathering or doing things to try to circumvent the law.
You know, I had not heard of that one. You think there's any similar sort of thing going on with coronavirus? You think there'll be some guy who comes out of his bunker in like 5 years to see if coronavirus has been if they finally got that vaccine or something like that? I mean,
yeah, we can only hope. We can only hope that they stay down there for that long. You know, it gives us an opportunity to try to rebuild once they're done doing their nonsense.
Now, have you seen any militia groups using this as an opportunity to grow their ranks in terms of specifically, you know, promoting, you know, their member, like trying to, you know, build membership from this?
Yeah, we see a really marked increase in the number of folks joining online militia groups, particularly on Facebook. Facebook has kind of become a haven for, you know, militias, three percenters, Oath Keepers, and other Minutemen and other so-called patriots.
Who are the big militia groups now? Because, you know, as someone who covers the far right, you know, frankly, actually, the militia groups are not the area that is my specialty, pretty much. So, like, I know there's the big groups, you know, the three percenters, the Oath Keepers, the Minutemen, like you just mentioned. But are those still like the main ones, or is there up and coming militia groups that are, you know, using this as to break out?
All of those, right? I mean, I think that there are lots of smaller, decentralized groups and networks, right? It's mostly run around a few kind of national chapters of groups like, you know, 3% United Patriots and other groups like that. But a lot of them are then broken down into state and then zones. They'll assign state different zones to kind of break down their membership. And I think, you know, our last check, we found at least 800 or 900 different militia sphere groups on Facebook, you know, attracting new members and bringing in tens of thousands of people into this stuff. You know, and for some of them, they're actually out doing training and, you know, live fire exercises. Others of them are just kind of, you know, inundating themselves with the kind of conspiracies that we're talking about. Right. So if they're a kind of a keyboard commando, they're sitting there and they're just being fed this stuff over and over again in their feed. And it, I think, is having a real impact on both how they act, you know, in the face of a pandemic, but also, you know, what they're looking at politically. So, you know, I think it has also moved to increase the fear level of folks, right? As we have moved into a phase where this stuff is, you know, is getting real. People are starting to have to shelter in place and stay at home. That is ringing the alarm bells of martial law, and all of their conspiracy, you know, spidey senses are going off. And so they are freaked out, right? So if you gaze into the feed of the militia sphere online, you know, you will see video after video of troop transport trains moving by, and you know, worries about weapons being deployed and the coming martial law, because they're worried that government is going to use this to come and take their guns, right? It kind of builds on the kind of rhetoric that they had around the Virginia legislature's attempt to put some restrictions on assault weapons and the kind of rally that they had there. And they're using that to kind of move this stuff forward to a larger audience. And they're being successful, right? Because I think more people are freaked out. They want to have folks to turn to. In part because they have both the built-in conspiracy theory network, but also because they've spent so long kind of talking about self-sufficiency and, you know, prepperism and preparing for the upcoming apocalypse. It's resonating with some folks, right? They're learning about this and they're hearing it and they're looking to get more involved and get more information because they're freaked out for their family. And those are the folks we're really worried about, the folks who, you know, we often talk about this kind of stuff as a conveyor belt, right? Where there are many different spots along the way in which people can get on that conveyor belt, but then they're eventually drawn farther and farther and deeper into the kind of hardcore white nationalism that we're really concerned about, you know, the kind of accelerationist neo-Nazi type stuff that we're seeing a flare up of now. But you know, everyone gets on it in their own spot. And this is just one more spot along the conveyor belt that's drawing people in deeper and deeper.
Right. Right. So let's move on now to let's ride that conveyor belt to the to the more overtly straight up white nationalists and how they are faring with the coronavirus. And let's start with this guy, because I saw he's mentioned in this great report you have out, but I had seen specific pieces just on this guy, and it's fascinating to me because I think this is a perfect example of how they're using the coronavirus to basically grow their own audiences. So there's this guy named Tom Kosinski, I believe that's how you say his last name.
And yeah, I think that's right.
Basically, he's a white nationalist who has developed a following for getting in early on the coronavirus podcast industry. He developed this coronavirus-specific podcast called Coronavirus Central, and he basically has become a go-to coronavirus expert on iTunes, you know, for podcasts. Like, people are listening to him for coronavirus information who have nothing in common with him ideology-wise.
Yeah, I mean, he was an out-and-out white nationalist who saw an opportunity, and, you know, I'll give him credit for being entrepreneurial in that respect, but, you know, he's using it to create a platform for himself and to try to mainstream himself, right? It's a pretty common tactic. You look for those moments of opportunity where you can move from the margins into the mainstream. You know, they are, as a movement, becoming much more adept at that. And the kind of moves that they make are quicker and harder to follow. So this was one of those that thankfully didn't slip under the radar. You know, some other folks did some amazing reporting on initially finding that, and we did some follow-up on it to, you know, get a better sense of who he was. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff we're seeing a lot more of, right? That, you know, there are those efforts to try to move into the mainstream, right? It is, you know, it is akin to, you know, kind of what folks like Jordan Peterson and some of the IDW folks did in, you know, taking the kind of self-help nonsense, you know, making your bed and moving that to try to push a kind of a larger far-right agenda, right? It's just one more example, right? They learned from Peterson and those other folks that if you hop onto a trend and you feel a need, you can then use that space to push your ideas. And so I think that's what's going on a lot more here, is that he was the first to do it. I don't think he'll probably be the last as this stuff goes on.
So how else are white nationalists basically using this coronavirus? We talked about the militia groups. We talked about this one specific guy who had the foresight in getting in early in the coronavirus podcast industry. What are we seeing from, I don't know, like the big white nationalist websites? Like, how is, I don't know, like Daily Stormer or VDare covering this all?
Well, a lot of them are using it, like VDare is using it as a way to push nativism and xenophobia, right? The kind of idea that, you know, I think it was Jared Taylor of American Renaissance, who's talking about how xenophobia can save your life, right? You know, at VDare, they're talking about how, you know, it's entirely rational to be scared of Asian Americans now, right? That their bigotry is in fact justified by the current situation, right? They decided that this was the moment to have an opportunity to talk about, you know, further advancing a kind of nativist xenophobic agenda, rather than, you know, spinning out anything new specifically. It was an opportunity to reinforce some of their ideas and try to make them more palatable to folks.
Right, right.
You know, that's certainly true for anti-Semitism as well. You know, folks like the American Identity Movement and some of the other more unabashed white nationalists who, you know, have anti-Semitism at their core have used this to roll out some of the, the anti-Semitic stereotypes, you know, like the memes about a Trojan horse being pushed up to the walls of the world and it being all to, you know, that coronavirus is nothing more than a Trojan horse to promote Jewish domination, or that Jews are behind the coronavirus, or, you know, a lot of those kind of different theories are, you know, being spread out there, you know, and it's starting to have real world implications. You know, we already saw in, you know, last week, the incident in Missouri.
Right. I was just going to bring that up. Perfectly. Yeah. Perfectly. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. You
guy.
Know, you had a, you had the incident in Missouri where, you know, a neo-Nazi accelerationist, decided that as the staying at home orders were going in, into place in Missouri, that he couldn't wait any longer. So he decided that he was going to, blow up a hospital that was housing coronavirus patients there in, you know, a small town just south of Kansas City, in part to encourage panic and disorder and to help accelerate the coming collapse of the current order so that they could bring about, you know, a race war and bring about, you know, their kind of Nazi state that they envisioned. You know, so that was the example of that. Just today, I saw another example, although it's not specifically white nationalist related, but in Los Angeles, someone who works in the military was arrested for driving his train at full speed off the tracks as a way to send a message that the coronavirus was a hoax. So, you know, this stuff is, again, you know, playing out in the real world. It's not just goofy, you know, it's not just goofy ass conspiracy theories that are bouncing off on 4chan, but it's actually impacting folks in the real world.
Right. Right. So with the guy in Missouri, it's interesting that, you know, he wanted to get ahead of the stay at home order as if he was going to follow the, that, like, you know, like,
yeah,
like, I'm going to commit this terrorist attack, but I got to make sure I follow the governor's suggestion. So I got to make sure I don't, it's not even like they made a law. Like, it's not in stay at home order. Yeah. It's like a legal, like, require, like, it's just the governor's suggestion. My God.
Yeah. I think he was worried that the, you know, what turned out to be the FBI agents he was buying the bomb parts from were actually going to stay at home and wouldn't have shown up to give him his bomb parts. So he was more worried about that than his own, enforcing, you know, the stay at home order. But yes, I think there is some, you know, absurdity to all of that. It is fortunate that he wasn't able to go through with this plot. I am worried that it won't be the last. You know, we are headed into, you know, we're now in the month of April. April 19th marks the 25th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. So whether it being somebody, you know, continuing to go down this accelerationist path or somebody wanting to mark that terror attack and the, you know, the murder of 168 innocent people in Oklahoma City with another dramatic incident is, you know, certainly something we're paying pretty close attention to at the Institute. And I think a lot of other folks are, too.
Right. So let's bring up, we had reached out to each other before the coronavirus pandemic hit, and you guys had a great report on Groypers. And I still want to have you on specifically to talk about them. So I don't want to use too much time to get into who they are, what they are, and everything in this episode.
Cool.
But Michelle Malkin has become sort of a hero to them. And she's out there also sort of, I guess, regurgitating what Jared Taylor's position is, which is interesting, being that, you know, Jared Taylor's a white guy and Michelle Malkin is not.
Well, you know, Michelle Malkin is now taking her calling herself Mama Nazi, right? Because she's become the mother of the Groypers, as she likes to refer to herself. And she has, and she's done exactly that, right? She's regurgitated all the white nationalist lines about COVID-19 and used it as a way, to further her stature within the movement, right? Anything she can do to prove her bona fides to the folks is something that she's going to try to do now that she's gone all in on that side, right? I mean, granted, she doesn't need to do a whole lot, you know, having written a book called In Defense of Internment.
Right.
But, you know, she's still really trying to show that she can stay up to folks like Patrick Casey, you know, who right. leads a group that used to be Identity Europa and, you know, a hardcore anti-Semite and, you know, white nationalist like Nick Fuentes. So, yeah, right. Yeah.
But what I'm saying, I'm going somewhere here. So here we go.
Okay.
So Casey, Taylor, and Malkin all are using this to push this sort of anti-immigration agenda here. And I'm going to now jump into the mind of one of these guys because I don't know if you've noticed, but a major thing in the white supremacist world is a lot of these guys are actually into Asian women because they feel like the cultures there fit with their whole idea of having the subservient wife, the trad wife, you know? Now,
yeah.
What do they think about this immigration when, you know, there are guys who actually go to these places to basically find themselves some sort of young wife who has no choice but to basically marry one of these guys, and they get their subservient wife. Like, they really think that just, like, cutting off the Mexico border to Latinos is going to do something to this. But the white guys who come back from China, for example, they're okay, I'm sure, in their opinion, right? I mean, are they?
Oh no, absolutely not, right? There is always a flexibility in their ideology that will allow them to carve out exceptions for, you know, for their personal proclivities or for the proclivities of their friends, right? I mean, that has always been the case with white nationalism, right? It's an incomplete and ill-formed ideology. So there are always those exceptions they'll be willing to make to see the kind of larger, you know, white ethno state come about. You know, not all of them are for complete and utter genocide of all people of color. Some are for simply, you know, relegating to people of color and Jews and others to second or third class citizenship status.
Right.
So there is some distinction and some debate within the movement confines about where that all fits. But yeah, it's always, you know, kind of sketchy when they start doing that stuff. And it's, you know, the kind of rhetoric that they use to talk about Asian women in particular, you know, is both girded by their misogyny and, you know, their racism and their white nationalism. It's still to further their kind of white nationalist goals and objectives.
Right. One of the funniest, you know, I bring this up because one of the funniest moments, one of the moments on the show I'll never forget is in one of the earlier episodes when I was interviewing Caitlin Bennett, who is now known as the Kent State Gun Girl.
And I remember this episode. It was hilarious.
And I was talking with her about her buddy. Shit, I forgot his name now. But he was the guy who was whacking everyone with a stick during the early 2017 protests, counter protests in what was it, Seattle, and then Berkeley.
Oh yeah, Kyle Chapman.
Thank you. Yes, Kyle Chapman. Yeah. And we were talking about it, and she goes, he can't be a white supremacist. His wife is Asian. And it's one of the funniest things I remember because it's like, damn, you really haven't looked into what your buddies believe about their, you know, they got a lot of racist thoughts about everyone, including what they think about Asian women. And that's what sort of attracts them to Asian women in a way, which is, you know, a story, you know, you probably do a whole episode on the weird mental problems with the people who believe that stuff. You know, it's,
oh yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, if we wanted to go down a road sometime, we could talk about, you know, Jean-Philippe Rushton, you know, one of the leading figures of the eugenics movement of the last 30 years, right? His whole thing was he spent entire academic career, you know, to study that there was an alleged inverse relationship between penis size and IQ, right? And, you know, yeah, I know. Yeah. He had a 35-year career doing that kind of stuff at a respectable Canadian institution, right? But also became, you know, a justification for white nationalists to further the kind of eugenics agenda in the 21st century that, you know, was, you know, clearly drawn out of the, you know, drawn back to, you know, measuring skull sizes and phrenology and that kind of nonsense.
Just want to say I'm smart, but not too smart.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Fuentes. You brought him up, and I definitely want to get to him. You know, we'll probably talk more about him way more in a. You know, I'd love to have you back on in a couple of weeks to talk about the Groypers in detail, because I think they really are worth their own episode. But let's talk about Fuentes. How's he handling all this?
Oh, you know, I mean, he's done a couple of things. You know, one is, I think it's, you know, he has gone down the rabbit hole of pushing all the kind of anti-Chinese conspiracy theories. But then he's also gone, you know, on this whole kind of leaning towards third positionist Nazi position, you know, talking about how, you know, the coronavirus has exposed a tenuous and fragile order upon which our society rests. And, you know, he's talking about, you know, how the domestic supply chains of food and water and things, you know, are potentially going to run out. So, you know, he's started to kind of move in that third positionist idea, you know, to try to push more of the idea that we need a strong state to deliver those kind of goods, and that there are some problems with capitalism. Right. In essence, what he's doing is he's doing a more extreme version of the dance that Tucker Carlson is now doing, right, in terms of, you know, at times talking about workers and, you know, some of the issues around big companies like Amazon and things like that and monopoly power, you know, as nods to, you know, the kind of increasing role for the state that it can have in promoting a kind of a larger white nationalist agenda. He's just doing that, I think, you know, in a much more conscious third position effort. In fact, he's on his show, he's talked about leaning towards a kind of third position view, which is a distinction from a lot of the rest of, you know, his white nationalist cohorts. And it'll be interesting to see where he takes that, you know, whether it's not just a fancy in this current era, or if it's something he's going to, you know, kind of move to as he sees the market changing a little bit. Yeah, so we don't exactly know where it's going to go, but something we're paying pretty close attention to.
Let me bring up him now, because I was going to get to him next, but I think he belongs in this conversation, because I've seen him sort of pushing the same rhetoric. Richard Spencer.
Yeah. I think Spencer has done a lot of the same, right? I think that they're now realizing that, okay, that this is the moment where you need a strong white state. The kind of libertarian ideals aren't going to work to bring about a white nationalist ethno-state, that you need that strong state to provide for, you know, as they put it, you know, the protection and security of the white race.
Right. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, during the coronavirus bailout discussion, when Congress was working on figuring out who was going to get all the money, was it going to be the corporations or the other corporations, and maybe we'll leave some leftovers for all of us. when that whole thing was going on, when that a couple of weeks ago, what was it last week or the week before that? One of the
seems like an eternity.
Right. Yeah, I don't even know what day it is anymore. It's April 1st, right? April Fool's Day. Happy April Fool's Day, everybody. Yeah. So one of the common conversations going on Twitter was that the Republicans, at least some Republicans, were out there floating bigger relief packages to ordinary workers. Like Mitt Romney wanted to give $2,000 to everyone. Some Republicans, I think, had suggested similar. And there was discussion on, were Republicans trying to outflank Democrats? Now, I don't think that's the case, although maybe some of them did. Like, I think Mitt Romney was being truthful when he thought $2,000 for... you know, we've seen this Mitt Romney as senator and how he is, and I don't think he's a, you know, he's not a leftist. He's certainly a right-wing Republican, but he seemed like he would be someone who would float $2,000 for everyone. I mean, Obamacare is his baby after all.
Yeah, sure.
So, but other Republicans, I just think they were, you know, we see what the package ended up being. It was not $2,000 or any sort of recurring monthly amount. It was Republicans fighting for the absolute minimum for a one-time for workers. But if we're going to talk about outflanking the left on this stuff, it seems like these guys, Spencer, and outflanking Democrats, I should say, Spencer, Fuentes, these guys seem like they are legit in what they're saying. And obviously they have their agenda they're pushing. They're not suddenly becoming leftists. And no one on the left should fall for this, their bullshit. But they know that this stuff plays. Which,
yeah, I think you're right.
Which is why it's so frustrating when Democrats, when at least moderate Democrats, the mainstream Democrat, doesn't get this. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I have, I mean, there's many reasons, because I'm personally, you know, find it interesting and am invested in it. But also, in terms of the show specifically, why I've been covering the primary so much, because if you're going to defeat a Donald Trump, you have to get what's going on here on the far right. And excuse me. And And Trump, while he doesn't agree with this stuff, he also sees, and maybe he's not smart enough on his own to see it, but his advisors see it. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if Stephen Miller is telling him every day, you got to come off more and more populist, without a doubt. But they see how this plays. They know this helped Trump. And, you know, Bernie Sanders, in my view, that's why he is the person best with the best ability to take on the whole, not just Trump, but the whole movement on the right. And, you know, that's sort of why I've been so intent on covering the primaries, because it really does fit into all this. I fear that someone like Biden, even if he beats Trump, you know, we're not going to see the destruction of the far right with a Biden administration. I'll tell you that much right now. If anything, you'll find a huge shot of adrenaline pumped into that whole movement. I'll tell you right now. I mean, the Bernie thing, they'd probably feed off him being Jewish, but when it comes off of when it comes to him trying to them trying to outflank the idea that he's a populist, there would be no success there, and that would harm their movement. I believe, I really do think that would be a huge hurt to that movement, because there are guys out there, there are people out there who are in that world because of the economic stuff. And you know what? If they got the economic stuff, maybe they wouldn't be so, you know, they probably would still be racist, but maybe they wouldn't mind it. You know, there's a subsection of that. And that is what I believe you find in those sort of people who are brainwashed by the YouTube stuff. You know, that whole new generation, they were looking for a scapegoat, and the far right gave it to them. But if they were taken out of that situation, they wouldn't need that scapegoat anymore. And I mean,
I think that's really important, right? That both you have the necessity of kind of universal programs to show that we're all in it together, and you, in essence, do two things. You remove the ability to be outflanked on your left by promoting ideas that are universal and helpful to everyone. And then you get to the situation where you are, in essence, putting a roadblock up to one of those entry points onto that conveyor belt, right? You know, some folks may find their way around it and find other ways to get onto that conveyor belt. But for a lot of folks, they're going to turn around and find, you know, another way to get involved. You know, it's not, you know, an economic or cultural issue specifically that is getting them on that conveyor belt, but it could just as easily take them down a road that leads them to, you know, to something more progressive. I think that's a really important thing too, right?
Right. I mean,
part of what we do at the Institute is our research is really designed to find those that are hotspots where that area, you know, where people are being targeted for recruitment and, you know, are being exposed to this idea, so that we can intervene in those areas and try to stop people from heading down those conveyor belts, right?
Right.
It's really kind of important to, you know, get ahead and start doing that in advance. So that's why we spend all our time doing all the research that we do. It's not, although we do find this stuff interesting and often pretty dang hilarious, it's also because we really want to get on the ground and figure out, you know, how we get to this stuff first. You know, and I think out of that, it can help teach us how, as, you know, those of us on the left can figure out messages that will reach those people before they head onto that conveyor belt, right? We both need to figure out the locations and that will reach us before they, you know, that rabbit hole.
Losing you on Skype again, but let's see. Just what was that last thing you just said? I just want to make sure we get it.
Oh, I was saying it's really important, you know, for those of us on the left, you know, to look at those spaces where white nationalists and others are trying to find those new members, right? And it's important for us then to intervene with something that both speaks to those people with, you know, a message that speaks to the issues that is really driving them towards that conveyor belt, but before they get there, and then speaks in a way that, you know, that resonates with them, right? Because I think that, you know, having done this work long enough, I know that, you know, I'm not the right messenger to talk to Zoomers, right?
Right.
And that's You know, you want to have folks have peer-based responses to organized bigotry at all times, right? You want to figure out, you know, how you do those interventions in ways that are both meaningful and timely and, you know, have a resonance with people. So, yeah.
I usually explain it like on this show, I usually mention, I use the term true believers. Like, I'm not saying, and I want to make this clear, I'm not saying that all of a sudden you got left-wing policies and Richard Spencer is not racist anymore. Nick Fuentes is not racist anymore. No, those guys are the true believers. They're the ones who actually believe this stuff. Either, it's not either, but it's a combination of both. They believe this stuff, and that's what their grift is. That's where they're making their money. They're not going to lose that.
Right.
So I'm not saying that, but they push this stuff because they know this is how you bring new people in. And yeah. if you want to understand this dynamic, don't listen to me saying it. Don't listen to Devin saying it. Listen to pretty much, and I feel confident saying this, every single person who's gone on the record to say, listen, I fell into that rabbit hole. I was a far right winger. I was a white supremacist. I was a neo-Nazi. And then I came out of that. Let me share with you who I am now. They'll never say, now I'm an Obama-Biden Democrat. No. They always come out and say, listen, what pulled me out of this, what made me realize that we're all in this together and we're all human beings and you know, it's us versus the people with the money and the power, and we need to all stand together, white, black, Latino, Native American, Asian, everybody. It's, they say it's the left that did that for them. You know, they, so I mean, that is the proof there. I mean, I've honestly never heard someone say, you know, I was a neo-Nazi and now I'm a moderate Democrat. Never heard it in my life. Never in my life have I heard it. If you are one, please reach out to me. I want you on this show and I need an explanation.
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think there's also this other thing going on that, you know, you really have to figure out, you know, what's driving folks, right? That, you know, at the Institute, we really wholeheartedly believe that movements matter. That's both why we track the movements on the right and also why we work to support and defend movements on the left, right? Because, you know, there is an important sense of identity and belonging that comes with movement politics, right? And so we want to help more people find that sense of identity and belonging and ways to plug in and give their life meaning that is something more than, you know, shuffling boxes at Amazon for 8-12 hours a day. Right, that they have, you know, agency in their life and they have the ability to do things that really matter to people. And so, you know, I think that's another thing we've got to start thinking more about is that sense of identity and belonging and bringing more people in rather than, you know, working to, you know, more narrowly and narrowly define ourselves as, you know, on the left.
Right. So, Devin, is there anything from this report that I left out? I want to make sure I get this all. Was there any specific thing that we seem to have left out? Because it's, oh, there was one thing I was actually unfamiliar with until I read Zyklon 1488. I'm just unfamiliar with that. What is Zyklon 1488?
It's a Telegram channel. No. You know, designed to, you know, it is the most awful group of memes, you know, designed for, you know, the Zoomers, right? But, you know, the whole thing is a play on a lot of horrible neo-Nazi tropes, right? Zyklon being based on Zyklon B, the gas used in the gas chambers during the Holocaust, and 1488, of course, being the numbers, you know, 14, you know, which stands for the 14 words,
right?
Which, you know, are the David Lane phrase about we must secure the existence of our, you know,
right?
You
know, 88.
I'm sounding a little bit like Joe Biden there,
right?
It's really because I don't want to repeat it rather than I don't remember,
right?
What the preamble is,
right? 88 is, and then HH for, as we all know, Hulk Hogan.
Spoken like a real wrestling fan.
Yeah.
Well, the one in this report that got me that I actually had to look up was the use of 110. You know, the number 110, it's actually what it stands for is it's actually 109 or 110. 109 is supposedly the number of countries that have, you know, that have kicked Jews out. And 110 is the hope that the United States will do that.
Right.
So, you know, the expulsion of Jews is something that, of course, in white nationalist circles, they're really excited about and hoping that the conspiracy theories they promote around coronavirus being a Jewish plot is something that they can get on board with and help move that along on the overall political agenda.
I need to jump on Telegram because I've noticed that Telegram is becoming a place where all these guys seem to have found as their final refuge. I mean, I guess it's sort of good that they're there in terms of it's easy to follow, yet most people are not going to go out of their way to do that. Like, it's not like they're in a private channel that we can't get into, but it's also there is an extra step to Telegram that would mean most normies who would usually come across this on YouTube or even just going to 4chan or 8chan, it's just that an extra step that some of them just wouldn't do. So I guess Telegram, if they were going to go somewhere, Telegram's the best place. It's not private, but it's not easily accessible enough.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Devin, you got to come back on this show because we got to talk about a lot more, especially that report on the Groypers, because I really want to do
a
complete episode on them because,
cool.
I mean, that is an interesting movement. If you were to tell me that the alt-right was going to basically, the most analogous thing to the alt-right in 2019, 2020 would be something called the Groypers and explain them to me, I would be like, man, interesting, but also how far they have fallen.
Yeah, you and me both. I had the same opinion when I started reading that stuff. Yeah,
right. But it is interesting to see who is in that now, because I mean, Michelle Malkin was a completely palpable to the right. You know, she wasn't. You know, she was a right winger. She was, you know, extreme right winger, but she was accepted by mainstream Republicans. And now that's completely, she's just, I mean, even they see that she's gone off the rails, which is, I'm not giving them credit. I'm just saying how far she's gone.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, because
they built that. I want to just add, they built that before you get, they built that.
Absolutely. That is absolutely true. They are responsible for all this nonsense. You know, during the Tea Party era, you know, we spent so much time trying to convince people that you got to pay attention to this stuff. It's going to come back to bite us. You know, and we were often met with, you know, deaf ears, but it is certainly coming back full force. And now to see a Republican group, you know, working to try to get Michelle Malkin kicked out of the 200 or so papers she's currently syndicated in is, you know, an interesting dynamic. Little too late, but, you know, things have certainly changed in the past couple of years.
Right. Devin Burghardt, president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. Tell everybody where they can find you and your organization. Hey,
yeah, you can find me, you know, you can find all of our institute's work at irehr.org. You can find me on, you know, on Twitter at dburghart, that's dburghart. And you can find us, you know, you can now download our new smartphone app called Trepper, the anti-bigotry app, available for both iPhone and Android. On the Google Play Store and iTunes.
Devin, thanks for coming on. If you'd like, definitely like to have you on soon again. And my best wishes to your coworker Chuck, and maybe next time he could even jump on and we'll all discuss this too. That would be a perfect scenario to show that he's defeated this.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, anytime, Matt. I really enjoyed it.
All right, take care. Have a good good night.
Too. Yeah, you too.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to jump to the second half of the show. I'll take some comments. Let's do that. But first off, patreon.com/MattBinder. If you can afford to become a patron, please do so. If you cannot, especially during these times, I completely get it. And do not become a patron. That's patreon.com/MattBinder if you can. We have lost a few patrons. It's okay, obviously, because I want everyone to take care of themselves. But the people who have stuck by me, I want to give them that shout out because can't do it without you. And those people are Abigail T, Adam Q, Alan B, Amanda H, Andrew C, Andrew H, Angela, R.E.R., Baka, Ben, Benji, Bobby M, Brosnan, Champagne Kami, Chris, Christine H, Colin R, Connor R, Cracker Barrel, C.T., Cynthia J, Dan K, Dank Uger, Dave K, Dave Z, David Z, I should say, Daya, Doug H, Dragonslayer, Eugene B, Froz K, FTW All Day, Greywind, Greg D, Grim, Hitesh, Igor D, Jack D, Jameson Test, Janelle A, Jasmine H, Jeremy M, John B, John S, Jonathan B, Jonathan L, Joseph H, Joseph R, Joyce M, Justin S, Katie S. Going to the next page here. That's right, two pages. Look at that. Where'd it go? Where'd the next page button go? I'm blind. There we go. Kaushal, Lance R, Lisa D, M. Carroll, Mariah, Mark S, Matt Z, Max W, me, Melissa M, Mitch V, Michael B, Michael J, Michael M, Mr. Danks, Nicole A, Namdenet, Null Style, Odeth, Paul M, Penelope D, Qster, Rad Dad, Remy, Ryan, Scott R, Seth K, Sean H, Snazzles, Stephen R, Stephen S, Steve A, TM, Tamney G, Terrence R, Hypervisor, This Is Not Pizza, Tina M, Todd K, Tom M, Vance S, Why That Tie Guy, Wootopian, and of course, last but not least, Zoe. Folks, youtube.com/MattBinder, subscribe to the YouTube channel, doomedpod.com for the podcast, also subscribe at iTunes and Google Play, wherever you listen to your podcasts, leave a review on iTunes. A written review is extra helpful, not just a star review, but I'll take a star review too. What else? Tell your friends about the show. Tell your family about the show. Spread the word about the show. Share the show. Tell me who you want to see on the show. Tell who else you listen to that you want to see me on their show. What else? I said the last episode I want to do more episodes while we're all home during this pandemic. I still want to do more episodes. Things are just kind of hectic with the kids during the day, and also working from home during the day. I'm very lucky to still have my job as a reporter for Mashable. I'm not complaining about that, but being home and doing all this definitely makes it a little bit harder. You have no idea how much work I do for Doomed on my commute. I'm not commuting anymore. What I'd like to do, actually, is I'd like to just talk to people about how everyone's holding up during this. Just shooting the shit and discussing life during a pandemic. This is uncharted territory for many generations. I think the last time there was a pandemic, I think my grandma, who was 96 when she passed away in 2012, that's when she was like one or two, maybe. We're in crazy territory here. So it would be cool to just talk with people, whether it be my listeners or just, you know, we could do a conversation on Skype, stream it on all these channels. Just doesn't have to be the usual sort of Doomed podcast episode. It could just be us talking about whatever is going on, because that's interesting enough during all this. We're living history, man. If you'd like to come on the show during one of those episodes, hit me up on Twitter at Matt Binder or email me. You know, my email's there too. Let's do some more streaming. And I'll still do the regular interview episodes like this with experts and reporters and writers and other leftist streamers, and we'll have a good time still. All around. All that said, see you guys. We're gonna do a member show. We went really over with the first half, but we'll still do a fun second half of the show for patrons. We'll do that right now. But for everybody else who's not watching the live stream or is not a patron, we'll see you all next time on Doom. I think I muted it too fast. Let me try that again. See you all next time on Doomed.